You are tuned into KBO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO's end of year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Now is the perfect time to contribute because a generous group of donors will match your gift one-to-one up to $10,000. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
Tune in to KBOO tonight at 8 o'clock for Squirrel Snow, the one show where we broadcast galactic awareness and animal awareness, where sometimes we have fascinating conversations with experts, authors, activists, and the fields of animal awareness and galactic awareness. And a lot of the time we play amazing music that could effectively raise your frequency of consciousness. Yes, that is Squirrel Snow. Tonight at 8 o'clock here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll play an end-of-the-year special, starting with a look at the most censored stories of the year, with Andy Lee Roth, co-editor of Project Censored's State of the Free Press. We'll examine how topics like fossil fuel use and dark money influence have been undercovered or obscured in the corporate media. Then we'll turn to Deborah Barsky, a researcher at the Catalan Institute of Human Paleoecology and Social Evolution and associate professor at the Open University of Catalonia. She'll discuss her fascinating book, Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Public opinion is deeply shaped by what we read, what we see, what we hear. It's why the role of a free press is critical to a democracy. Only a well-informed electorate can best govern itself. But given the skewed coverage of critically important stories in our corporate-dominated media landscape, it's no wonder that our democracy remains in deep trouble. Each year, the group Project Censored gathers together the most censored or undercovered stories of the past year and edits them into a book. And today we'll learn what some of those stories are. Andy Lee Roth is Associate Director of Project Censored. He coordinates the project's validated independent news program, has co-edited several editions of the Censored Yearbook with Mickey Huff, including the newest book, State of the Free Press 2023. Welcome to the program, Andy.
Thanks so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to join you on Rising Up.
So give our audience an overview, if they haven't heard of Project Censored, what this is about. This is not a new endeavor. You and Mickey have been doing this for many years. And sadly, it sort of gets more relevant year by year for you to cover stories that are censored. So what exactly is it?
Well, with the corporate media's narrow definitions of who and what count as newsworthy, I guess Mickey Huff, the project's director, and I and those of us who work at Project Censored have good job security, because every year there's no shortage of important stories that the corporate news media either marginalize, distort, or blockade altogether. And that's basically been the aim of Project Censored since it was founded at Sonoma State University in California in 1976 by Carl Jensen. The goal has always been to try to bring wider public attention to important stories that have been given short shrift by the corporate news media. And so from the start, that project has been a student-driven project. This is something, when the project was established in 1976, there were very few media watchdog organizations in the United States. We are one of the oldest running such organizations. Now, thankfully and happily, there are many, many more organizations doing important work to point out bias, slant, spin, outright propaganda. But Project Censored remains distinctive for the central role played by students. Every year, so some of the stories that we'll be talking about today, all the stories on this year and all 47 of the project's annual lists are initially identified and vetted primarily by college and university students from across the country.
And so these are stories that never make it into the corporate media, or make it into a very limited form in the corporate media, or maybe a biased form in the corporate media?
That the answer to that question, Sonali, depends on a kind of case-by-case basis. Some of these stories that we'll talk about today have not been covered at all in the corporate news media. So that would be the in some ways, the most stark, strong form of this sort of filtering process that we'll talk about. But others are covered, but covered in a way that shrouds or makes unclear the full impact or import of the story. And in some ways, these stories are the most pernicious of all. This type of story is the most pernicious of all, because people will come and say to us, oh, well, I saw that story covered in the Washington Post. That's not a censored story. And we'll say, but did you compare, as the students working on these stories do as part of their critical media literacy training, they compare and contrast the stories for what's included in the independent coverage of the topic, as opposed to what's featured or highlighted in the corporate news coverage. And there often are striking differences, especially around solutions to systemic problems, which far more frequently are covered in independent news coverage of the topics the project tracks compared to the corporate news coverage.
So let's talk about some of these stories. There's so many of them, and I thought we would start with one topic that there was a time that the corporate media didn't cover at all, and that was climate change. Climate change used to be something that the independent media would, you know, constantly be harping about. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I remember we would have regular stories about climate change, and the corporate media, when it covered it, it would generally be a sort of both sides story. Well, yes, some scientists say this and other scientists say that. Now, there is general agreement that climate change is very real. The corporate media has caught on, albeit late. But what aspects of the story about climate change are they not covering?
One of the major aspects that ends up being our top story for the 2021-2022 news cycle is the extent to which the fossil fuel industry is subsidized by governments around the world. I'm going to give you a stunning figure that it'll take a moment. We should all do a collective inhale while there's still breathable air to inhale. A study by the International Monetary Fund, published in September of 2021, found that globally, the fossil fuel industry is receiving subsidies of $11 million per minute. So in the time that, since you introduced this topic, and the time I've finished giving my first quick answer about this story, ExxonMobil, BP, et cetera, will have received some $11 million in subsidies from various governmental agencies in nations around the world. So this story was broken by Damian Carrington at The Guardian and also Eduardo Garcia at Treehugger. And what we found was that as of when State of the Free Press 2022 went to press, no corporate news outlets had covered the IMF report. Part of what Eduardo Garcia describes here is how when governments subsidize fossil fuel industries, and here we're talking about both direct subsidies, outright kind of payments, but also indirect subsidies, things like not holding fossil fuel corporations responsible for the costs of their doing business, what in economics are known as externalities, because the corporation that's making the money externalizes the costs of doing business to some other third party. When governments don't tax, say, fossil fuels enough to produce revenues, the consequences are higher taxes in other areas, increased government deficits, and decreased spending on public goods. So the ripple effects of these subsidies, in terms of, as one expert noted, propping up a failing industry, to what it means for social programs in our communities, couldn't be much more profound.
And of course, we need to be ensuring that or incentivizing the phasing out of fossil fuels. Subsidies do the exact opposite. Another story in the Project Censored State of the Free Press 2023 that has got much less attention in the corporate media is who is actually doing the generating carbon emissions. We just had a wrap up of a major global UN conference on climate change, the Conference of Parties on Climate Change that took place in Egypt. And tell me what your book also covered in terms of how wealthy nations are continuing to drive the emissions, even though the corporate media might want you to believe it's India and China.
Right. Yeah, exactly, Sonali. This is another story in our top 25 list this year, reporting from Sonia Klinsky at The Conversation and also Tawanda Karambo at Quartz Africa. The key upshot is that about 5% of the world's population is responsible for more than a third of global greenhouse gas emissions. This will not be a surprise to regular listeners to this program, but wealthier nations such as the United States, Canada, and Australia are releasing on average hundreds of times of greenhouse gas emissions per capita compared to the countries in the world, in continental Africa, in the South Pacific, that are bearing the heaviest brunt of these emissions and the consequences of the climate crisis. This is actually a story. We had a debate, and we had an internal debate about this story when the voting process took place this spring, whether we ought to include this story, because it basically duplicates a story we covered in last year's yearbook, how climate debtor nations have colonized the atmosphere, which was our number four story in the State of the Free Press 2022 yearbook, our last yearbook. But we agreed that both the scope of the problem, which is existential in scope, right? We're talking about the future of the planet here. And also the truly shocking quality that corporate news media have not covered these issues. They have not covered the differences. So we do hear about climate change, but we don't hear about differences in the global North and the global South and these relationships of debtor and creditor when it comes to who is putting greenhouse gases into the environment and who is paying for the consequences of that. So we know, when we did the story research this year, we agreed this was such an important story that even though it's, quote, in some ways the same story as a story we ran last year, we would run it again. It's also worth updating in the sense that corporate news outlets, major US corporate news outlets, so places like the New York Times and Time Magazine, are beginning to cover, to some extent, environmental racism within the United States. But we're still not seeing coverage that thinks about environmental racism as a geo-global issue.
Right.
And this story about wealthy nations driving climate change with devastating impacts on poorer countries is an example of the kind of reporting that ought to be commonplace whenever a climate is talked about, but is, as best our research can determine, still something that is a perspective brought by independent journalists rather than their corporate counterparts.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored, and we're talking about the latest State of the Free Press 2023, which he has co-edited with Mickey Huff. There are numerous stories more than two dozen stories that have not gotten the coverage that they deserve and yet are so critical to social justice and to things like the environment. Let's talk about another topic that was a bit of a theme through the book, and that is the impact of what's known as dark money. You had three stories out of 25 on dark money. The first one basically on how it undermines democracy here in the United States. What is dark money, Andy?
So dark money refers to donations intended to sway political decisions. So everything from elections to Supreme Court nominations. But these donations, dark money refers to the idea that the donations, where the money is coming from, what in effect the money trail is not publicly knowable. It's hidden from the public. So the idea would be that dark money is influencing political decisions in favor of these unknown entities, individuals or groups that have agendas, but those agendas aren't necessarily in the public's interest. But the public has no awareness of where this money is coming from. So that influence is ultimately counter-democratic. It undermines democracy.
And so what this particular story about how dark money is undermining democracy here in the United States, give me a sense of it, because if you don't know where the money is coming from, you don't know what the agenda is. And these days with rising inequality, there are, you know, billionaires, there are wealthy corporate CEOs and corporations, institutions and individuals that have very different interests and goals and motivations than the public, the rest of the public at large, right? So how is dark money impacting our democracy? And again, this is not a new problem.
No. I mean, there's always been influence of wealth on the democratic process. The angle here, I think, is the new angle here, or the relatively new angle here, is the hidden quality of the influence at work. And the way, I'll say a little bit more about Igor Dersh's report for Salon, which was focused on Supreme Court nominations, and how organizations such as the Judicial Crisis Network, the Federalist Society, and the 85 Fund have been channeling money into, in effect, the kind of almost like electoral campaigns for the latest string of Supreme Court justices. And so this isn't just reporting from Salon. That report is in turn based on a study done by Open Secrets that found, for instance, that the Judicial Crisis Network had invested literally millions of dollars in supporting the Supreme Court nominations of Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. When you think about
six right-wing judges on the Supreme Court right now, and really have made a huge difference to the political landscape, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And when you think about how politicized those nomination processes have become, how openly politicized they are, now we have this subterranean input of there are millions of dollars in dark money coming in, also shaping attempting to shape, I guess I should say, the public's perception of who these people are and what kind of role they'll play when they enter the court. So that is one component of it. But one of our other stories that links up to this is how across the nation, states are passing laws that will make it even harder to disclose dark money influence on our political process.
And let's talk about that aspect of it. New laws, the title of this is New Laws Preventing Dark Money Disclosures Sweep the Nation. And it's one out of 25 stories in Project Censored's State of the Free Press 2023, co-edited by Mickey Huff and my guest, Andy Lee Roth. So we're seeing these laws that are cropping up, laws that are often, well, you tell me what kind of laws they are, but they are, I guess, suffice it to say, regressive, right?
Right. The goal of the law is so dark money is by definition, has these non-disclosed elements. We don't know where the money is coming from, who or what organization is seeking to influence. This legislation that we're seeing crop up in states across the country is actually legislation that will create loopholes in existing laws to make it even more difficult to disclose the influence of dark money on the political process. The model legislation here comes from, perhaps no surprise, none other than ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, their model legislation has either been adopted or is under consideration in something like 17 states. I won't read them all, but from Oklahoma and Arizona and Mississippi to West Virginia, Arkansas, Iowa, North Carolina, South Dakota, and Florida. States at the time, State of the Free Press 2023 went to press. Some 17 states were either had passed or were in the process of legislating on changes to their laws, state laws, that would in effect make dark money disclosures that much harder to disclose. So this is really a kind of a throttling down of the public's right to know, right? First, dark money, as we've been discussing, compromises the democratic process, and it undermines public faith in government and election processes. And then state legislators, following the models of this conservative organization, are in the process of passing laws to make it even harder to kind of pry open this dark money dynamic. That's a dangerous scenario. And again, one that is in our top 25 story list this year, because when we researched it, we found no substantial corporate news coverage of of these laws as a kind of as a wave sweeping the nation.
Let's wrap up our conversation discussing another story centered on dark money and how it fuels transphobic opposition to the Equal Rights Initiative Amendment, rather, and Equality Act. Tell me about this. Transphobia as a favorite pastime of today's modern conservative movement, unfortunately. What does this story uncover?
Well, so just to back up for a minute, the Equality Act would amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act to prohibit discrimination based on sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. And of course, the Equal Rights Amendment, the ERA, is a policy designed to ensure equal rights for all citizens, regardless of sex or gender. As Truthout reported in March of this year, major groups that have been opposing the ERA and the Equality Act, often on transphobic grounds, so groups like the Eagle Forum, the Concerned Women for America, and the Independent Women's Forum, all of which have been opposing the ERA and the Equality Act, all are receiving dark money. We know that, for instance, again, it's difficult, like the investigative journal, this is why we need independent investigative journalism, is to try to track down and pry open these money channels, these hidden money channels. So what Julia Peck, Ansev Demirhan, and Alyssa Bowen at Truthout found when they dug a little bit was that the funders of the Eagle Forum and its related Eagle Forum Education and Legal Defense Fund had received tens of thousands of dollars over a period of several years from places like the Bradley Foundation and other massive foundations that have deep connections to the far right in the United States. So we're talking about, you know, groups associated with billionaire Charles Koch, the Center to Protect Patients' Rights, et cetera, et cetera. The IWF, one of these groups lobbying against the ERA, they're very much continuing in the, I guess, time dishonored tradition of Phyllis Schlafly. Yeah. Was initially founded as the Women for Clarence Thomas back when Thomas was embattled, the embattled Supreme Court nomination hearings of Clarence Thomas. And this group rose to Thomas's defense when he was charged by Anita Hill with allegations of sexual harassment.
Well, that says plenty.
Yeah. So at Project Censor, we're always trying to look at, well, what's the corporate, you know, and Sonali, you started by saying, well, are these stories simply not reported? We found, for instance, over the last year or two, there's been more and more reporting in places like the Washington Post, NBC News, the New York Times, major US news establishment outlets. We have seen coverage about the rise of anti-trans legislation in states across the country and efforts at the federal level. But what we found when we researched this story about dark money fueling this kind of transphobic opposition to the ERA and the Equality Act was that that's an angle of this story that is just utterly missing from the kind of establishment and legacy news media.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Andy, for joining us today. People can get their own copies of the book at and most bookstores, and is there a website?
Yes, projectcensored.org. We have an archive of all 47 years of the project's top 25 story lists at projectcensored.org.
Thank you so much again, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Andy Lee Roth, Associate Director of Project Censored. He coordinates the project's validated independent news program and has co-edited several editions of the Censored Yearbook with Mickey Huff, including the new book State of the Free Press 2023. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Many of us recall our history teachers telling us in school that knowing history helps us understand the present and helps us ensure we aren't doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. A new book by a researcher of human prehistory says that exploring the past can help us understand the future. In her book, Human Prehistory, Deborah Barsky focuses on the invention of the earliest stone tools that Homo sapiens and their ancestors built, and how they help define what it means to be human. Deborah Barsky is a researcher at the Catalan Institute of Human Paleoecology and Social Evolution and associate professor at the Open University of Catalonia and Rovira y Virgili University in Tarragona, Spain. And she joins me now to discuss her book, Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. Welcome to the program, Deborah.
Thank you very much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So first, let's define prehistory. We may think of those of us who aren't history experts or prehistory researchers may think of everything that's happened in the past as simply history. What is prehistory?
Indeed. Well, prehistory, when we're talking specifically about human prehistory, so what we're referring to is really the very long period of time before writing, really. What we prehistorians work with are mainly, especially for the older periods, are mainly stones and bones and, you know, whatever the fossil record can bring to us from the deep past. So in more recent periods, when we have written documents or iconography, for example, in proto-historic periods, interpretations can be made a little bit, let's say, easier. Whereas when we're working in prehistory, we're working with silent stones, silent bones, and the stratigraphical contexts in which they're found. So we really have to extract the maximum information that we can from these contexts and from these cultural markers, I suppose you could call them, for the very ancient periods of our human prehistory.
So what are the timescales we're talking about here? X number of years ago, are we talking about pre-civilization?
Yeah, the timescales tend to be pretty scary for maybe our listeners who are not accustomed to working in, you know, such long chronologies. But generally, we can consider, well, what makes us human? And when along this very long timeline can we find in the archaeological record some evidence of this becoming human? So really, I think we're working with two main criteria, one being bipedalism, which is considered today as one of the starting points from which our ancestors began to bifurcate along the human lineage.
So basically and started second, to walk on two legs.
Yes. And the second would be toolmaking. Toolmaking as a very important bifurcation along the hominin pathway towards, let's say, becoming human. Of course, it's important to remember that we're not talking about a straight linear evolutionary pathway, but something that's really rather bushy and complex, with a lot of stops and starts along the way. And also it's important to remember that the fossil record and the archaeological record is really very fragmentary. And the further we go back in time, the more fragmentary this record is. So it's like a puzzle that we're trying to put together daily. And even as our own technologies are improving, well, we're also improving the ways that we can locate finds and study them and also share them with the public.
So are we talking on the terms of 100,000 years too? I mean, you know, how old is the earliest tool? What defines a human-made tool?
Well, the oldest stone tools that we can recognize in the archaeological record are around 3 million years old. And wow. They're found in Africa. But these are recognizable stone tools. So this point of emergence is important, I think, to underline. It's probable that early hominins were using stone for a very long time prior to actually shaping it into tools that we can recognize today. And when I say what we can recognize today, well, if you're out in a savanna landscape somewhere in Africa looking for stone tools, what you can recognize is something that presents a kind of systematic, right? Stones that are broken in a non-systematic way would just look like broken stones and would be unrecognizable to us. But it's possible that, hominins were using stone for a very long time, perhaps for throwing, probably for pounding activities like we can observe, for example, in some contexts with chimpanzees and bonobos, for example, nutcracking activities. So perhaps breaking inadvertently stones in the beginning and finding these broken bits of stone useful, perhaps to perform different activities, and then making the choice to actually purposefully extract flakes from bits of stone. And that's when you get into the systematic, and that's around 3 million years old. We have a site now in Kenya called Lokaleli, which is dated to 3.3 million years ago, which was only discovered, I think it was published in 2015, so it's quite a recent discovery. So the dates are always being pushed back actually even further.
Wow. Timescales evolutionary timescales? Are these timescales across which our species may have biologically evolved?
Yes, and that's one of the very interesting aspects as well of studying these very ancient techno-complexes, which we call for the oldest, the Oldowan, after the eponymous site of Olduvai Gorge. It's fascinating because they were made by hominins that were very different from ourselves, of course. Homo habilis, which is the first Homo, actually emerges in Africa around 2.8 million years ago, 2.5, 2.8 million years ago. So around the same time or just after the first recognizable stone tools. And we believe today that other kinds of hominins were probably also making these first stone tools, Australopithecines and Paranthropus, because another thing to remember is that our genus Homo actually shared these African landscapes with other kinds of hominins over many thousands of years.
Right. Today, Homo sapiens are the only only species within the Homo genus. Am I saying that correctly? Left.
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Indeed. Most of us have heard of Neanderthals. That's another one, right?
Of course,
yeah.
Homo neanderthalensis, and actually the hominin family tree has been growing over the last quarter of a century or so, and as we discover new sites and as the dates are changing, it's been fascinating to see that since the emergence of Homo sapiens, which is now placed at a much earlier time than previously believed, around 300,000 years ago, thanks to a relatively new discovery from Morocco, Jebel Irud site, 300,000 years old for our genus and species, Homo sapiens, and new discoveries being made in Eurasia as well of different kinds of hominins arriving, migrating into different areas of Eurasia around the same time as our own species. And so the cohabitation of Homo sapiens with, let's say, Neanderthals or even Denisovans was actually going on for a period that was longer than previously believed.
So what did the tool making tell, or what does the tool making tell us about what it means to be human then? If there were Homo sapiens that were actually, and our related ancestors, actually carving these tools to pound food or whatever, maybe hunt, what does that tell us about being human in terms of the social relevance to today's society? I know I'm sort of fast forwarding really fast, but for me, this is what's fascinating to us today, right? Those of us who are not in the thick of the academic prehistory, what does that prehistory tell us about who we are today?
Well, it's interesting when you go back to the oldest, let's say, stone tools, and see their evolutionary pathway, let's say, from the Oldowan to the Acheulean. Those are the two oldest techno-complexes known to humankind. We can see different processes going on that are still going on today. And one of them is complexification, or let's say another process as well as acceleration. So the first stone tools are relatively simple or opportunistic, let's say, but they do have a systematic. And they were made by techniques that needed to be learnt and transmitted. And these techniques that are learnt and transmitted, therefore, are necessarily cultural, because that is the very definition of culture, isn't it, when we're talking about transmission of knowledge and such. And as we go through time, we can see this complexification in tool making, and even tools at the beginning of the Acheulean that are shaped harmoniously with, let's say, symmetry, like the Acheulean bifaces. So it's rather difficult to learn to make an Acheulean biface. And so we can say that the humans were investing in the learning process. They were investing in culture, because obviously tool making was providing the hominins with some kind of advantages, let's say, compared with other large carnivores that were roaming in the landscape alongside them. And some neuroscientific experiments have been done looking more specifically at the human brain during the stone napping process, and in particular during the making of more complex tool types. And it was found that the parts of the brain that are activated during this process are the same as those that are used, for example, for language, for volumetric planning, for prediction. So in a way, these parts of the brain are co-opted towards tool making. And this can sort of explain, I think, in many ways, the increasing brain cerebral capacity of hominins through time that seems to happen in synchronicity with the complexification of the tool making process itself.
So it sounds as though a lot of what we now know about human biology offers hints about and allows researchers like yourself to extrapolate to what might have been happening on the order of a few million years ago with our species.
Yes, well, the field of human prehistory is exponentially expanding as well with all of the new technologies that are being created. I mean, it's a specialty that embraces really all sciences, we can say, for locating sites, for dating sites, for studying the artifacts that they yield, and for studying also the stratigraphical contexts in which they are found. So really, we're using, you know, biological sciences, but as well many different kinds of specialties that are including computer specialties these days, 3D analysis, all kinds of modern technologies that are being applied to archaeology and to human prehistory, and that are enabling us not only to find more sites, but to date them more precisely and to study the materials much more rapidly than before, and to share this data using innovative museographical strategies. And that is sort of awakening also in the general public, I think, this interest, which is a natural interest. I think everybody is interested to know, you know, where do we come from? And especially today, where are we going? Where is the human species going? Why are we the only species left today on the earth? And what is our position relative to other life forms?
Right.
You know, so
in your book,
all of this really can be related, I think, to technology and this major bifurcation that occurred some 3 million years ago when we chose to invest in something that is extrasomatic. It's an adaptive strategy that is outside of the biological realm. And indeed, there are other tool-making animals. Some people claim culture in other kinds of animal species, but none of these species has developed technology to the point that humans have. And so it's important, I think, to follow this evolutionary pathway to see how we invested in this, why we invested in it, how it changed our brain, how we came to invest more in symbolic thought processes as well that are linked to language, that are linked to the development of these specific areas of the brain, and inevitably linked to tool making as well.
Deborah Barsky's book is Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. What have you learned and other researchers learned about human prehistory that helps us understand, for lack of a better word, tribalism, right? So there's a lot of, there may be hints about how humans have treated other species, but what about how we've treated one another, particularly groups of one another that we might perceive as different from ourselves, even though, of course, we're part of the same species?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I do talk about this in my book as a particularly interesting point. If we look at the process of cultural complexification, we do get to a point where we can see cultural differences within each technocomplex. And this begins as early as the Acheulean, I claim, where we have reached the point of sufficient cultural complexity where each hominin group can develop some kind of idiosyncrasies, let's say, in the way that they make bifaces. So they can contrast this cultural material with the way perhaps that another hominin group is making their bifaces. And so they're going to—
And remind us what you mean by bifaces again?
Oh, it's, well, it could be any kind of tool really, but a biface is a symmetrical tear-shaped tool that is emblematic of the Acheulean period. So these perceived cultural differences, because we don't have any biological differences, of course, we modern humans are all one and the same, but we have a lot of cultural differences, and we can trace back the beginnings of these cultural differences to these little idiosyncrasies that occurred within even relatively simple toolkits. And the capacity for humans as well to remain within one geographical context, like let's say early hominins of the Oldowan and the Acheulean periods were migrating into different lands, exploring into different lands. But once fire making was established and once tool making reached a sufficiently high level of quality and capacity, hominins were able to remain within a specific geographical region. So they were able to perceive their cultural differences in relation to the geographical region in which they inhabited. And this to me was the beginnings of the first ideas of, you know, let's say borders, some kind of symbolic dividing line between different human groups, but that is culturally based, because There's no biological basis for it. And this is something that was further developed through time and that we have established in intonation states today, which, you know, it's something that is still very present today, but which is a completely symbolic construction. So I think we can learn a lot from prehistory if we go back to the emergence phase of these so-called differences, and if we consider them for what they are, which is really cultural constructions, the symbolic constructions that we have invented to make differentiations between different human groups. But in today's globalized world, these differences are being effaced and have less and less, are making less and less sense.
Speaking of globalization, let's talk about man's relationship, humans' relationship to nature. So there's the relationship between groups of humans, groups perceived to be different, the advent of borders. You can think about the origins of racism and imperialism, etc., in that way. But what about the fact that we have found more and more innovative ways to disentangle ourselves from nature in ways that, you know, we're reminded of often by indigenous groups. Today, indigenous groups are trying to remind us that humans have to live in harmony with nature if we are to survive. But where did that split happen? I think often we might think of it as happening with the advent of industrialized agriculture, but did it happen even earlier?
I don't know if you can actually pinpoint an exact point in time where the alienation from nature occurred. I think the development of technologies has given a human some kind of illusion of superiority, some kind of desire to be somehow different from the rest of the animal world, which is, you know, I mean, we remain inevitably linked to nature. We are biological beings, and there's no denying that. But people are searching in technologies to differentiate themselves from the rest of the natural world. And we can see today that this is having very serious repercussions on not only the human species, but all other species on the planet. So whether or not you can actually pinpoint an exact point in time where this, I see it rather as a process. And as our technologies have developed ever more complex and superior, let's say, this is continuing.
And so, there be a is there a way to understand from prehistory and from what we've learned about prehistory, is there a way to understand religion? Religion may be something that kind of is a bridge between you know, our alienation from nature as well as our propensity to have tribalistic differences with one another. Why is there a human need to believe in an entity that we cannot actually see and touch, that we might want to believe is sort of pulling the strings behind the veil? Where does religion come from, as far as you can understand?
Religion, yes, I think we can go back in time and try to, well, instead of religion, I would call it perhaps spiritualism, because religion gives the idea of institutionalized religion, which is more of a modern construct. But spiritualism, which is very difficult, of course, to perceive in the prehistoric record, does become apparent in some particular contexts. For example, people often talk about, let's say, the first burials that we recognize among the Neanderthals, some 200,000, 150,000 years ago. When there is intentional burial, that suggests that there's some kind of belief, perhaps in life after death, some kind of belief that it is important to offer the defunct a particular context in order for this individual to continue on, let's say, into an afterlife. So burials are really considered one of the first inklings of some kind of spiritual sentiment, let's say, in our hominin ancestors. So, I mean, where does the whole religion come from? I mean, there's still questions that we humans are not able to answer, and one of those being, you know, what happens after death, let's say. Today we use science to try to answer as many questions as we possibly can, but there are still many unknowns, and we humans need to fill in those gaps, and religion is a way for people to fill in the gaps, let's say.
Right.
Let's say religion tends to be very strong in peoples in low-income countries, perhaps, where suffering is rife, where children are dying inexplicably to their parents, from where there's a lot of cruelty. Religious sentiments tend to be stronger in these contexts because they have to try to somehow justify or you know, reason to be able to survive and to live with these incredibly difficult experiences. So what about
science? You know, today we talk about the scientific method, but really it is a very human thing to try to understand the logic of how things work. It is how we have evolved, even if we haven't identified the scientific method, you know, hundreds of years ago or thousands of years ago. Presumably humans used the scientific method to build things, to make some sort of progress, to build technologies even. We being able to do science itself is also a very human thing, right? And one could argue that even creating those tools that we started talking about is a sort of approach to or inroad to science.
Yes, indeed. Transforming the world around us and combining different materials to create new materials. I mean, one example, of course, would be fire making, which in the oldest contexts, let's say in South Africa, I believe now is the oldest context where fire making has been attested at around 1 million years ago at the site of Wonderwork. And we have here something that is really transformative in so many ways, gives so much power to humans to fight off other carnivores, for hunting, for transforming materials, creating new materials even later on by heating, settling into lands with harsher climates, staying late into the night to perhaps recount stories. Fire was a very transformative technology. And these are, you know, early scientific achievements, certainly. Some argue as well, for example, that the use of ochre, also in South Africa, in another cave site called Blombos, this time in a more recent context, around 100,000 years ago, where ochre was worked being combined with other materials, like animal
basically fats, a color ochres, right?
Exactly. So it's this idea of transforming materials to create new ones to fill our needs and desires. So that's kind of a power giving thing when you consider it.
Well, Deborah, I hear your cat wants us to wrap up our conversation, so it's a good time for us to say goodbye. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Very interesting and fascinating subject. Thank you for helping translate some of your academic work to, you know, the rest of us, and putting it in terms that have a context for our modern world. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your questions.
My guest has been Deborah Barsky, researcher at the Catalan Institute of Human Paleoecology and Social Evolution. And we've been discussing her book, Human Prehistory, Exploring the Past to Understand the Future. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune in to K-Boo tonight at 8 o'clock for Squirrel Snow, the one show where we broadcast galactic awareness and animal awareness, where sometimes we have fascinating conversations with experts, authors, activists, and the fields of animal awareness and galactic awareness. And a lot of the time we play amazing music that could effectively raise your frequency of consciousness. Yes, that is Squirrel Snow, tonight at 8 o'clock, here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.